Zechariah chapter 10. We're in the midst of prophecies of Israel's restoration and future glory. Most of the second half of the book of Zechariah has that theme. We'll see there are some exceptions, but by and large, that is the theme. So we begin to read, "Ask rain from the Lord in the season of the spring rain, from the Lord who makes the storm clouds, and he will give them showers of rain to everyone, the vegetation in the field." Now, a wise reader of the Bible always remembers that the chapter divisions are not original to the text and are sometimes artificial, sometimes highly artificial. Why talk about asking the Lord for rain? Well, because the previous verse described a time of plenty and prosperity in terms of grain and new wine. You need rain for good harvests, and the rain brings the good wine and the grain. The agricultural economy of the Levant, like all agricultural economies, of course, but much more in the dry Middle East, depends, always has depended, upon rain, and especially the rains that fall in the spring. For that reason, it's not really a surprise, human projection being what it is, that the gods of the ancient Near East were thought to provide rain. That's how they provided fertility in the field, by bringing rain upon the ground. Baal, for example, was regarded as the god of the storm, of lightning and thunder. Drought was the worst of scourges in that part of the world. So a crucial test of Israel's faith in Yahweh was whether she looked to him for the rain, because rain was what they absolutely had to have to survive. "For the household gods utter nonsense, and the diviners see lies. They tell false dreams and give empty consolation. Therefore the people wander like sheep. They are afflicted for lack of a shepherd." Now, the people of the ancient Near East typically placed their confidence for the provision of life in idols, which were thought to represent their gods, and many of those idols were representations of relatively minor gods, household gods. They also trusted diviners, people supposedly able to predict the future. The point of divination, of course, was that if you knew the future in advance, you could plan accordingly, avoid disaster, and take advantage of opportunity. This is still the faith of a great many people in our world today, including a host of people who are smart enough to know by now that no one can reliably predict the future of the stock market or the economy or the weather or much of anything else for that matter. But so anxious are people for success, as they were in the ancient world, so helpless do they feel before the powers of this world that they invest their hope in household gods and diviners, and since there is no alternative, refuse to be deterred by repeated failure. Empty consolation is exactly right. That's what idols and diviners sell. You will remember that divination was as strictly forbidden in the law of Moses as was the worship of idols. Israel's trust was to be in the Lord himself and in what he had revealed in his word. Those two things were all that Israel had to know. As Samuel Rutherford summed all of this up in a beautiful little aphorism, duties are ours, events are the Lord's. We cannot know the future, so we are not obliged to attempt to find it out, which is a good thing, because any attempt we make would be a failure. As the next verse is going to make clear, Israel is not without a shepherd. These people that are being described as relying on household gods, not Israel, but their neighbors, They're not without a shepherd, they're without a good shepherd, a reliable shepherd, a faithful shepherd. My anger is hot against the shepherds, and I will punish the leaders, for the Lord of hosts cares for his flock, the house of Judah, and I will make them like his majestic steed in battle. The word the ESV translates leaders in verse 3 is literally the term for the male goat, here used in a derogatory sense of a leader who exercises his influence over others by bullying the rest of the flock. From him shall come the cornerstone, from him the tent peg, from him the battle bow, from him every ruler, all of them together. Cornerstone, the solid foundation of something. Tent peg, something that makes a tent stable and secure. The battle bow, the great weapon of ancient Near Eastern battle, are all images of leadership and are so used elsewhere in the Old Testament. They shall be like mighty men in battle, trampling the foe in the mud of the streets. They shall fight because the Lord is with them, and they shall put to shame the riders on horses. Now, the military, this is a rather wrenching change from the pastoral image of the shepherd and his sheep to that of the battle and the general. But remember, shepherds had also to protect their sheep from various predators. So a good leader not only leads his sheep, but leads them in fighting against their enemies, as we're soon going to read in verse 7. I will strengthen the house of Judah, and I will save the house of Joseph. I will bring them back, because I have compassion on them, and they shall be as though I had not rejected them, for I am the Lord their God, and I will answer them. We began the chapter by asking God, and here he is promising to answer. Now, once again, Judah and Ephraim, here Joseph, represent the restored people of Israel, the people of God in their entirety. Throughout Zechariah and often in the Old Testament prophets, this is an anticipation of Pentecost and the worldwide mission of the church, a church that will finally embrace every tongue, tribe, and nation on the land by saying Judah and Ephraim, or Judah and Joseph, the principal patriarchs of the south and the north, you're encompassing the entire people. Now, the Lord had rejected the northern kingdom. It had been destroyed, and its people had been scattered to the winds by the Assyrian conquest. To be sure, as we know from Kings and Chronicles, a few people from the northern kingdom had survived the Assyrian deportation, had come south, and had been assimilated into the population of the southern kingdom. But the northern tribes, as distinct populations, disappeared and were never restored. As you may know, the fact that the 10 northern tribes were scattered by the Assyrians and were lost to human history has led to all manner of speculation concerning what have been called the 10 lost tribes of Israel. Some have thought that the British and American people are the descendants of those tribes. That is, of course, the white Anglo-Saxon British and American people. And there are a great many other theories of the same type, all of which are silly. The Bible tells us explicitly how David's fallen tent is going to be rebuilt in Acts chapter 15, citing Amos chapter 9, and the answer is it will be rebuilt by the Gentile mission. Then Ephraim shall become like a mighty warrior, and their hearts shall be glad as with wine. Their children shall see it and be glad. Their hearts shall rejoice in the Lord. I will whistle for them and gather them in, for I have redeemed them, and they shall be as many as there were, or as they were before. Near Eastern shepherds typically whistle for their flocks, summon their flocks by whistling. They do so even today. This is a beautiful anticipation of the Lord's remarks in John chapter 10 to the effect that he has other sheep that are not of this fold, that he will call them also, they will hear his voice and follow him. Though I scatter them among the nations, yet in far countries they shall remember me, and with their children they shall live and return. I will bring them home from the land of Egypt and gather them from Assyria, and I will bring them to the land of Gilead and to Lebanon till there is no room for them. He shall pass through the sea of trouble and strike down the waves of the sea, and all the depths of the Nile shall be dried up. The pride of Assyria shall be laid low, and the scepter of Egypt shall depart. As you read more and more of the prophets, you begin to realize that all of these are metaphors. They are images of great victory and triumph for the people of God. There is a reference here to Israel's greatest act or moment of salvation in the past, the Exodus from Egypt, and a new act that is being forecast that will be like it, bringing back the people from exile in Assyria, which in the language of the prophets regularly means replacing the lost 10 northern tribes with a great people drawn from everywhere. Egypt and Assyria stand here for all the oppressors of the Lord's people. Gilead and Lebanon are historic centers of fertility and stand for the prosperity the Lord will grant his people in the future, which prosperity has already been described in a number of metaphorical ways. And the passage through the sea stands for the power and salvation the Lord is going to reveal when he delivers his people from all their enemies and grants them a rest in a place of plenty, happiness, and goodness. I will make them strong in the Lord, and they shall walk in his name, declares the Lord. Now, this chapter and the one that follows it is most explicitly about bad and good leadership. We have that theme introduced in the second verse of chapter 10, and if you turn the page, you will see that it is still the theme as chapter 11 ends. Woe to my worthless shepherd who deserts the flock. Problems with leadership had already surfaced in the post-exilic community. We'll consider that theme next time, but there's something else here, and very obviously so, something that deserves our full attention. The question with which the chapter begins is simply this: who or what do you count on for what you most need and desire? The story of Israel's life, as you well know, can be told as simply their constant succumbing to the temptation to count on someone else or something else rather than on Yahweh. They counted on other nations to bail them out of some political or military danger. They counted on their own prowess to make a success of life in Canaan. And over again, they were tempted and succumbed to the temptation to count on the idols of the ancient Near Eastern world, of which they were a part. All the while, they were being told by the Lord's prophets to forsake these other confidences, to count on the Lord, not on the prince, not on themselves, not on some other country, certainly not on the ridiculous idols of the nations and peoples around them. But their idols are silver and gold, made by the hands of men. They have mouths, but they cannot speak, eyes, but they cannot see. They have ears, but cannot hear, noses, but cannot smell. They have hands, but they cannot feel, feet, but they cannot walk, nor can they utter a sound with their throats. Those who make them will be like them, and so will all who trust in them. And you remember the taunting jibes of the prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah. Look, they said, you take a piece of wood, and out of half of it, you make a god for yourself. The rest of it, you use in the fire to keep warm or to cook your food. Or, they say, be sure you get a good craftsman to make your god for you, since the last thing you want is for your god to fall over. Hello. No wonder, then, the moments of high satire when Dagon falls before the Ark of the Lord in the Temple of the Philistines, or Baal was bested on Mount Carmel by the quiet prayer of the prophet Elijah. And no wonder that nobody today prays to Baal or Chemosh or Marduk or Zeus or Jupiter. They're dead. They never were alive. We look back on them and find them something of a joke and wonder how anyone ever really took these things seriously in the first place. But today, all over the world, hundreds of millions and billions of people pray to Yahweh, the God of Israel. Household gods seem to us more than faintly ridiculous, but we should be careful to heed the Bible's teaching that idolatry comes in many forms, and we sophisticated inhabitants of the modern West are hardly immune to its lure. In Ephesians 5, we read, "For of this you can be sure, no immoral, impure, or greedy person, such a person is an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of God and of Christ." Or as Paul puts it in 1 Corinthians 10:6, "Now these things," he's speaking of the exodus from Egypt and the Israel's subsequent unbelief, no matter what God had shown her or done for her, "these things occurred as examples for us to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things as they did. Do not be idolaters." Anything can be an idol, anything that takes God's rightful place in our hearts. And in particular, anything we are trusting for the fulfillment and the happiness and the success of our lives. That's why Calvin called the human heart an idol factory, and why John finished his first letter with the line, "Keep yourselves from idols," as if in saying that, he'd said everything about the Christian life. Human beings worship something. All of them do, all the time. They have been made for worship. And in their rebellion against God in sin, they worship anything and everything except God. So idolatry is not only the constant temptation of human life, it is the fundamental problem of human life. And to a great degree, that means it is the problem you and I are struggling with all the time. Sexual pleasure, the desire for wealth, both in the Bible are forms of idolatry, for not only do people worship such things, love them, and desire them, but they count on them for the happiness and the success of their lives. We, of all people, should be the last to doubt this, suffering as we do from a barrage of Viagra commercials day after day, or finding ourselves swimming in a sea of ads that, in effect, promise the kingdom of God if only we will buy this or acquire that. Gambling is the act of an idolater, someone who so wants money, so trusts the power of money to bring him happiness, that he's willing to risk, to waste indeed, the little money that he has for the tiny chance of gaining more money that he does not have. Power, fame, pleasure, health, wealth, education, jobs, hobbies, people, they can all be idols of the human heart, all occupy a place in our hearts, in our confidence and trust that should be occupied by the Lord alone. Malcolm Muggeridge put it this way shortly before his death. In the 20th century, man has created the most disastrous of all images, which is himself, and he falls down and worships him. Never in human history have the unworthwhile things of life been presented so alluringly through advertising. This is Vanity Fair into every single person's sitting room, hours and hours of it, day after day. And the same is true of divination. There is nothing wrong, of course, with the attempt to make responsible, prudent use of information and to plan for the future as much as it can be planned for. But men have always gone far beyond that and do as much today as they have ever done in the past. It's one of the deceits of the technological revolution of our time. The dominant role of technology in our life feeds the illusion that we can not only fix every problem, but that we can predict the future. I've long been amused by the fact that the college football rankings are said to be reached by a combination of input from the so-called human polls and what are typically referred to as the computers. Computers, of course, sounds very scientific. Now, as anyone knows who thinks about this at all, the so-called computers are really just calculators. They serve to spit out a ranking according to the algorithms developed by the very human creators of these ranking systems. Their advantage is that they calculate very quickly. But those calculations, in fact, could be done by hand. But if they were done by hand, with pen and ink on a legal pad, no one would say that the college rankings are the result of a combination of the human polls and the legal pads. That doesn't sound scientific. That sounds to be the equivalent of saying that the rankings are just the result of guesses by a variety of human beings. What is more, the computers are exactly as likely to be wrong, and they are wrong a great deal of the time, as the coaches or sports writers who rank the college football teams, each according to some theory of his own. If the computers could predict the outcome of football games, there would be a lot of people by now made rich by betting on college football. There aren't. Stanford was favored to beat Michigan State, Georgia favored to beat Nebraska, Baylor was favored to beat Central Florida, Alabama was heavily favored to beat Oklahoma. Oops, 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 and oops. But that bit of divination is chump change compared to the economy and the stock market. Thankfully, we all saw the collapse coming in 2008 and got out of the overpriced real estate market just in time. Oh, wait a minute. We didn't. Well, at least we could predict how the economy was going to recover as the result of this step taken by the government or that step. Oh, wait a minute. We didn't get that right either. Never has there been a people so confident that they can predict the future as we are confident today, and never has there been less reason for that confidence. And I'm not talking about the millions of Americans who actually still read their horoscope in the newspaper every morning or who consult psychic hotlines. I'm talking about highly educated people who imagine that the future is now accessible to them ahead of time because their powers of prediction have a scientific basis. Baloney. They are absolutely no more reliable than the court officials who studied livers in the ancient world in order to advise the emperor about what was coming next, or the Oracle of Delphi, who was at least smart enough to couch her predictions in terms so vague as to mean virtually anything. Alexander the Great wouldn't invade Asia until the Oracle told him that he was going to be successful. She said, "I see a great victory." She didn't tell him who the victor would be or how long he would be victorious. Too bad she didn't tell him to be sure he got home before his 33rd birthday. The brute fact, forced upon our attention 100 times in Holy Scripture and confirmed 1,000 ways in our observation of human life, is that the idols of the human heart are just that. They're false They're cheap imitations of the real thing. They can't save, they can't predict the future, they can't help in the meantime. They're worthless. They're a distraction. The only one who can help us is the God who made us and the world and everything in it, the God who rules over all things, who knows what the future is because he has determined the future himself, the God whose goodness, love, and justice we can count on absolutely, the God who has revealed his purposes, his intentions, and his expectations for our life in his word. Where does our help come from? 1,000 times in the Bible we are told our help comes from the name of the Lord who made heaven and earth. And that is the theme here, and emphatically so. Let me take you through on a quick run through this 10th chapter. It begins with the imperative, ask rain from the Lord. The point being, as the first two verses make clear, he is the one, in fact, he is the only one who can actually control the weather. But now go on. In verse 3, we read, for the Lord of hosts cares for his flock. That is, he's not only able to help, he is willing to help. Now follow the thread as we proceed. In verse 4, from him shall come, from him, from him. 3 times we are told that what we need will come from the Lord. In verse 6, the Lord himself speaks, I will strengthen, I will save, I will bring them back, I will answer them. The Lord alone can do these things, and he shall. In verse 8, I will whistle for the sheep, for I have redeemed them. In verse 10, I will bring them home, and I will bring them to the land of Gilead and Lebanon. And finally, in verse 12, I will make them strong. The entire chapter comes in the form of an emphatic contrast between what idols and diviners can't do and what Yahweh has done, can do, and will do. The whole point of that contrast is obviously that it's vain to look for what we want and those things that we need to those who cannot deliver the goods. It's a reminder to Israel that when she trusted her idols and her diviners, she ended up either dead or a slave in some faraway country. When she trusted in the Lord, she walked out of bondage in Egypt, weighed down with the wealth of the greatest nation on the face of the earth. It's always amazed me, I'm sure it has you as well, that people, even intelligent and highly educated and thoughtful people, are so unthinking about the idolatries of their lives. You don't have to be a genius to realize that while money can buy you certain pleasures, you still are going to die and you can't take it with you. Fame, power, celebrity, pleasure, success in one's career, even family, marriage, and children, all the many things that human beings count on to make them happy and successful in life, all of it is so terribly temporary, so short-lived, so evanescent. But nobody ever seems to put it to himself or herself in that way. I'd like to be rich for a short time before I die. I'd like to be famous before I'm completely forgotten. Or I'd like to fill my life with pleasure before the pain descends. And they certainly never say, never even imagine saying to themselves, I want some really temporary wealth, pleasure, or fame before I begin paying for my idolatries in the world to come. Alexander, whom I just mentioned, was the most powerful human being on the planet for a couple of years. But what good did that do him when he got sick and died at 33 years of age? And if there is a judgment, as certainly there is, those few years of conquest and celebrity may have cost him an eternity of additional woe. Here in Zechariah 10, we're being reminded that nobody and nothing can give you what you want and really need, except the Lord alone. This is something you and I need to be reminded of 10 times every day that we live in this world. It's something we need to be teaching our children repeatedly, and something we need to be bringing up with our workmates and our neighbors. We have, every human being has, an inbred desire to be happy. And there's nothing wrong with that. Just think for a moment about what happiness really is for a human being. True and lasting happiness. It's a sense of fulfillment in life. It's having an easy conscience. It's having our relationships healthy and strong and loving. It is enjoying the good things that God has put in this world. It is being satisfied to contribute something important to the lives of others. And it is, above all things, to be at peace with God, and so with time, death, and eternity. Armand Nicolai, the professor at the Harvard Medical School some years ago, surveyed psychologists all over the United States and then published the results of what happiness requires. That was the question. And chief among the things happiness requires is an acceptance of the reality of death. God holds all of these blessings out before us as motivations for seeking Him. He's done this in Zechariah already a number of times, and He's doing it here. Jesus is going to do the same thing. He begins His famous Sermon on the Mount by telling us how to be happy. To be sure, He gives us a recipe for happiness that is quite different from that which the world recommends, but the end is the same. He is still talking about how to be happy. Happy or blessed are the poor in spirit. Happy are those who mourn, and so on. Man is a slave, Augustine said, to that by which he wishes to find happiness. Well, then Zechariah is telling us, and the Lord through Zechariah, be sure you are enslaved to someone who can actually make you and keep you happy. Pascal put it famously in his Pensées. All men seek happiness. This is without exception. Whatever different means they employ, they are all after the same end. The cause of some men going to war and others avoiding it is the same desire for happiness in both, attended with different views. The will never takes the least step but to this object. This is the motive of every action of every man, even those who hang themselves. He's right. Happiness is the great issue, question of human life. If you stop and think about what Pascal said, you'll find that he's right. Everything everybody does, every day, all day, is in one way or another done with a view to acquiring happiness. You may think that thing that you are doing is dull. You may think it is pointless, but you do it anyway because you think you're going to be happier having done what your employer wants you to do than you will be if you are found not having done it. The whole world is longing for happiness, but the tragedy of the world is that it continues in a kind of perverse obsession to search for happiness where it cannot be found, where it has never been found, and where it will never be found. Where does most of the misery in this world come from? Indeed, almost all of the misery in this world, all over the world. It comes from someone or many someones looking for happiness. Here's the rub. If you look for happiness in another person, in something, in some predicted outcome in the future, in some status or pleasure, you're going to be disappointed. The greatest work of non-Christian ethics ever written remains Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. According to Aristotle, no one can be happy if his circumstances are bad. But if that's true, men are doomed never to find anything but a faint and fleeting hint or shadow of the happiness he or she is longing for. Because not only is human life almost always difficult and hard in some way, it is doomed to end so much sooner than any of us thinks. Pascal continues, And yet, after such a great number of years, no one without faith has reached the point to which all are continually looking. Everyone complains. And you don't complain unless there's something you're unhappy about. Princes and subjects, noblemen and commoners, old and young, strong and weak, learned and ignorant, healthy and sick, of all countries, all times, all ages, and all conditions. This world, your house, and your heart rings with complaint. All the things you wish were different than they are. A trial, this looking for happiness, a trial so long and so continuous and so uniform should certainly convince us of our inability to reach true happiness by our own efforts. But example teaches us little. What is it then that this desire and this inability to fulfill it proclaim to us, but that there was once in man a true happiness of which there now remained to him only the mark and empty trace, which he in vain tries to fill from all his surroundings, seeking from things absent the help he does not obtain in things present. But these are all inadequate, because the infinite abyss can only be filled by an infinite object, that is to say, only by God himself. We who are Christians, became Christians, or have continued to be Christians for this very same reason, that we might be happy. But if so, how foolish of us, particularly, when through spiritual indolence or unwatchfulness, we begin unwittingly, perhaps, to put our trust or to base our hope for happiness in someone else or something else than the Lord himself. Whether it is the rain or the right kind of leader or forgiveness or right relationships with others or adequate provision of food, clothing, shelter, the solution to some particular problem we are facing in our life, or in whatever other way, we long for Gilead and for Lebanon. The Lord alone can give it to us. So we ought to be looking to him, praying to him, counting on him, seeking from him what our happiness requires. Here's the challenge of this chapter. Force yourself to see your idols and your diviners for what they are. A bit of nonsense, really. Soon to be as well thought of as the household gods of the ancient world. Somebody's joke. Think your way clear to what real happiness actually is. And if you do, it will be obvious to you where that happiness must come from. And it's not simply because the all-powerful and loving God, he alone can give you what you want. It's more than that. He is what you want. Hence the beautiful conclusion of the chapter. What is the final, perfect happiness all human beings seek and that God has promised to give to his people? It is to walk in his name and to be strong in him. Many of you will have read that brilliant and beautiful paragraph near the end of C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. He's talking about how in the Christian faith and in the Christian life and experience, everything finally depends upon God being in our life and our being united to him. It's not simply a matter of God giving us things. It's our living in him. There is no other way to the happiness for which we were made. Good things as well as bad, you know, are caught by a kind of infection. If you want to get warm, you must stand near the fire. If you want to be wet, you must get into the water. If you want joy, power, peace, eternal life, you must get close to or even into the thing that has them. They are not a sort of prize which God could, if he chose, just hand out to anyone. They are a great fountain of energy and beauty spurting up at the very center of reality. If you're close to it, the spray will wet you. If you're not, you will remain dry. Once a man is united to God, how could he not possibly live forever? Once a man is separated from God, what can he do but wither and die? There is the summons and the promise of this chapter. The Lord is here. He's offering himself and his life to you. Take it. Take all of it you can possibly get. Get as near to him as you possibly can and stay as near to him as you possibly can. Walk with him, because with him comes everything you ever wanted in your life and much, much more.